Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, thoughts on race-conscious admission programs on Kentucky campuses, Crystal Wilkinson on her new book, Praise Song for the Kitchen Ghosts, and Atlantic writer Tom Nichols on the prospects of a U.S. military under the command of an authoritarian White House. Now that there's been some time to think about and process last summer's U.S. Supreme Court decision effectively ending race-conscious admission programs at colleges and universities, Gerald Smith, host of our series on racial justice and equality, welcomes Aaron Thompson, president of the Council on Post-Secondary Education, himself a Black Eastern Kentuckian who was the first in his family to go to college and earn a Ph.D.
Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Thompson.
Thank you, Dr. Smith.
Well, today I'd like to speak with you about the Supreme Court decision that was issued a few months ago addressing the legality of race-conscious affirmative action in college admission programs. Of course, as you're familiar with that ruling that involved the admissions programs at Harvard and the University of North Carolina, and of course, it was a controversial decision in the eyes of many in more ways than one. In fact, the chair of the United States Equal Employment Opportunity Commission issued a statement soon after that decision in which she said that the decision is a departure from decades of precedent and will undoubtedly hamper the efforts of some colleges and universities to ensure diverse student bodies. Do you believe the court's decision made higher education less accessible to certain groups?
Great question, and I'm going to answer quickly yes, but I'm going to give you some caveats and some backdrops to that answer. First of all, what we know is over the last many decades, many of us have been working really hard to ensure that no matter what background you're from, you would have an opportunity to get a quality education that would allow you to participate at an equitable level in this society. And we've gone through a lot of years where we've seen how historical disenfranchisement has had an effect on population groups, whether you're Black or brown or poor. And so what has been put in place have been some guardrails, true enough, but also some action that would allow us then to try to catch up, if you want to call it that. Many of us call it equity. And we worked hard toward that. And so the decades and years that's gone into accomplishing this, the Supreme Court's action, although was expected by us in Kentucky and has been for a while, will have an effect. And how it will have an effect is this. There are so many students who already believe that college and universities aren't designed for them. This goes to having an input in their minds that other people feel that way too, right? The Supreme Court ruling really will not have a lot of practical application for us in Kentucky. I mean, we haven't used race-based admissions for a long time. But think about what this is. You know the way our minds work. You already know the way that many of our students feel like they don't have the opportunity to succeed or even have the opportunity to get into college. This goes to helping many of them validate that that is actually true. It's not really true, but they're going to think that. Now, that's the one thing. So many of our predominantly white universities, I think it will have an effect in a negative way. That's why we have to work doubly hard to make it not have one. I think it will assist our historically Black institutions and our minority-serving institutions. I think it will help in those areas. So it will have an effect. It's just given us more energy now to really help all those students know the opportunities that we're offering them in Kentucky.
Do you foresee universities placing less emphasis on test scores, grades and high school class ranking, and more on the application essay in order to boast diversity among students admitted to their universities?
Yes and no. And let me tell you what I mean by that. Kentucky was the first state when I took over higher ed. We went to a test optional state anyway. So we were already putting less emphasis on test scores. Now, we were putting more emphasis on high school grades and those courses that they took and the overall ability that students had holistically to be successful in college. So we start looking less toward just peer admissions and more toward how we help students get where they need to go once they do get admitted. So we will probably be employing then more holistic ways of doing that, yes, no doubt. But we were moving toward that in a very fast way before this decision, and we were one of the very first states to do that.
Mm-hmm. How would you define a holistic admission process for students?
Several things. First of all, when you think of student success, you don't think only of the academic readiness of it, right? That's worth about 20-25%. But you also think about, do students really know what college is for? Do they know the advantages of going to college? Do they know how to actually maneuver the process to get in the college? And do they know it early enough? So holistic means that we're going to use things like our dual credit as a way to help them to build a pipeline. It also means that we will need to probably do more interviews, because in many ways, students don't know how to maneuver all those other pieces. We need to also understand where students are coming from. That's why we're trying to build on our campuses, things like better mental health services, other wraparound services. All of those elements, I think, will go more. So admissions become more than just one static point in time. It becomes much of a longer linear process that's going to take our K-12 counterparts to work with us on getting there. We may even look at some other abilities that they may have if they're not a traditional age population group, like what life experiences they're bringing with us. So to me, Dr. Smith, it's going to become much more of a qualitative understanding of a student's background and what they're bringing to the table and the likelihood of what they could be adding to the table, not just getting from it. In other words, we learn more from people different than us than from people like us. That's an advantage to higher education and higher learning. So you'll see much more of that way for us to do it. It takes longer, but it's even a more right way of doing it if you think about it. And that way we can design our campuses to be much more of that place where a student will feel a sense of belonging.
Does this decision impact recruitment and outreach programs in higher education, pipeline and pathway programs and data collection? Are there bridge programs, especially for Black and Latino programs?
It will, because we have to really watch that. When we were recruiting, the Supreme Court decision allowed us to still look at the background of a student. So we're going to have to be cognizant of how we're looking at that background from multiple lens, right? And not just from one race lens, as an example. So not that we've done a lot of that, but we know there's a likelihood that that could be the case. We're going to have to rethink about how we're helping our admissions counselors, recruiters to think that way. Number two is that we're going to have to then help design a system like bridge programming, in which the council has done that the last 3 years, that would allow students historically disenfranchised to be able to get skilled up even before they get to our campuses. And that becomes a recruiting process. So all of those ways we have to do. Now, let's get real. When we talk about the importance of this and why this was, I think, will have a deep negative effect if we're not careful. And I'm going to brag a little bit. Kentucky's number two in the country now in completions, and we're closing gaps for underrepresented populations faster than any other state. Not because of our admissions practices, but because of the way that we have holistically worked with students. We have to make sure, Dr. Smith, that this doesn't have an effect on that. We're going to have to make sure that we can give students in the earlier years really a path of thinking about the value of college and the output and how to go about finding the right college that will suit who they are. So this puts more onus on us in higher education to work with K-12 ever more in depth.
Do you think diversity training is still needed in this country?
I think the idea that the more we learn how this world is not a monolithic world, the more we understand that, the more we understand exactly, it's going to take more people that look like me to help educate people like me. That more we understand that diversity is a sense of learning as much as it is to recognize the aspect of one's demographic characteristic. More we understand that higher education in the past has been designed around diversity. That's why you have arts and sciences, the humanities, the hard sciences, is that it gives you a more whole way of doing it. More we understand that it's about civic engagement, more we understand it's about critical understanding and learning, a creative output. All of that has to be still in the process of our educational system in a very proactive way. If we're doing diversity training just to say we're clicking off a mark and this is how you treat Black people, this is how you treat Latinx people, or this is how you do that. No, I don't know if that was ever of much importance. But I think this calls us to really look deeper in how we recognize on our campuses and measure the competence that we have in helping all students and faculty and staff realize that curriculum and pedagogy are two of the primary elements by which we can educate our people at a higher level. And you have to have diversity as a not only a topic of conversation, weave throughout the conversation.
All right. As a closing question, I just kind of want to circle back around to how we can advance racial equity, you know, despite the Supreme Court's ruling.
Well, in my life and in your life, race has been a big part of our lives in more ways than one. We can talk about the culture, if you will, of who we are based on race. We can talk about how society has indoctrinated race as a part of the culture of our society. So the idea that if we believe that racism still doesn't exist, we are living in a place that, I mean, I don't live there yet. You know, I wish we did. You know, it may be a goal or a vision we have for America still, no doubt. But the only way we can get there is to talk about respect and talk about understanding and talk about learning from people that we perceive to be different than us. Until we get to that point, we're going to have racism. It's baked in somewhat. So how do we unbake it? Well, you do that with a level of awareness, with a level of emotional intelligence, with a level of learning. That's what we stand for in higher education. So without a doubt, you know, we can say it's gone because we have a court system say, hey, it's gone. But it doesn't mean that it's gone. And I think us as educators and those of us who are in leadership, no matter where we're at, we should want everybody, and I'll use Kentucky since that's who I represent, everybody in Kentucky to be able to come to the table, say the richness of who I am with my demographic background, as well as my culture, that I can come here and add to our society. I can be a productive member of our society. I want to be. And the idea that we're going to have to understand we're in a multiracial society. I mean, you're a historian. We know where race came into effect from 1619, 1690. We know that. But the more we realize that we can use that now to get away from real racist processes, we can. And the only way we can do this is to look at those institutional discriminatory barriers that kind of codify that in our system. So for me, it has to be something that we're not afraid to discuss, but one that is coordinated within us as the purveyors in higher education to be able to make sure that we get everybody to that finish line where we're trying to get them to.
That's Dr. Aaron Thompson, president of the Kentucky Council on Post-Secondary Education. I'm Gerald Smith with Eastern Standard Radio.
Tom Eblen hosts our series on Kentucky literature, and Tom's back with a guest whose latest book has enjoyed rave reviews even before it officially publishes.
Crystal Wilkinson is an award-winning writer and creative writing professor at the University of Kentucky and a recent Kentucky Poet Laureate. She grew up on her grandparents' farm on Indian Creek in Casey County. Her novels, stories, and poetry speak to the Appalachian experience from a Black woman's perspective. Her newest book does that, too, through the powerful forces of family and food. Praise Song for the Kitchen Ghosts, stories and recipes from five generations of Black country cooks, tells the story of Wilkinson's upbringing and ancestors through their connection with food. It is a beautifully written memoir that includes some of Wilkinson's favorite family recipes. They sound so good, I think I gained weight just reading them. Crystal Wilkinson is here with us today to talk about Pray Song for the Kitchen Ghosts. Crystal, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us some about your family history that led to this book.
Well, it started, you know, my grandmother raised me, so she was the core of my life and was one of the main cooks in the family, of course, as most grandmothers are. And then I discovered my furthest woman ancestor, Aggie, who was known as Aggie of Color, was born in 1795 in Virginia and likely brought to Kentucky as an enslaved child. And so I came upon her when I was at a writing retreat in Florida, and I got obsessed with her and wanted to find out all I could about her.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us some about the kind of food you write about in this book and some of the food you enjoyed as a child.
Some of the food is just plain Appalachian food, you know, chicken and dumplings are prominent, cornbread, mutton. And then the food sort of travels in the book. So some of the recipes are more contemporary. Some of them, me and my husband owned a bookstore and a cafe for a number of years. And so some of the recipes are from that. So I've kind of written it in such a way that the food travels through time. Mm. One of my favorite chapters is what these women know about bread. And so it sort of travels from Aggie's time as an enslaved woman to my, I imagine, my grandmother as a young woman. She got married when she was 14, a young woman cooking bread in her house. I imagine her mother. And then I write about myself cooking bread, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the oldest of those recipes was about ash cakes, which I wasn't familiar with. That was,
yeah.
That was an interesting. So where they would kind of wrap it in a leaf and cook it in the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what is it about food you think that forms such connections with people, whether they be family or friends or down through time like this?
Yeah, I mean, food is culture, right? Just like accents and music and literature, food is also culture. There are these little nuances, even within Appalachia, within Kentucky, and, you know, whatever culture you're looking at, there's these little nuances about food. As I was doing my research, and I knew this innately, but one of the things that was so interesting to me is how different my Kentucky country was than a deep Southern traditions, you know, mainly because of the weather. And so even that weather changed made things different to where, like, my family, unlike my southern part of my family that could, you know, cook a hog and put it on a barbecue grill or put it on a spigot, my family in the hills had to think about winter coming. And so it had to think about preservation. So there's a whole thread of different kinds of preservation through there. So there's those kinds of nuances that make us different culturally as far as food is concerned.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned that your grandfather, Silas, cured hams and did other and made sorghum. It's a really interesting chapter about how he made sorghum and how you've kind of adapted that when you had your bookstore into, mm-hmm. Into a latte. Tell us some of the other things that they did to kind of not only to get by, but to really create food that they enjoyed.
Well, of course, the whole hog had to be preserved from snout to tail in some ways. So there was a time where they, you know, they had chitlins where they he cured hams. My grandmother made souse, would take the head and cook it and make souse. Fat meat was cured and preserved to cook with beans. And so we eat it now because it tastes good. But back then, they had those little slivers of meat for the nutritional value. The same way with, like, spring tonics and going out in the woods and finding food. You know, I do it for fun because it's fun to sort of have that nostalgia and sort of remember. But like my aunt said in one of the chapters, my aunt's 86, my aunt Lovester, and I was asking her about going out in the woods and finding things. And I asked her, did she like the way it tastes? And she said, it didn't matter if you like the way it tastes or not. You eat it or die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what made you, you know, obviously, if you've liked this food and it's been important, what made you think there might be a book in this project?
Well, I had written an essay that was commissioned by Emergence Magazine. And so I had an essay called Praise Song for the Kitchen Ghost. All of these things sort of converged. The writing retreat in Florida, and I also had a writing retreat in upstate New York when this essay called Praise Song for the Kitchen Ghost was due. And so I wrote this lyric essay sort of combining my family's food ways and the old time traditions with a little bit of fiction in it about Aggie. And I had all those things combined in this essay. And then a friend of mine, Ronnie Lundy, who's the author of Vittles, well-known Appalachian food waste person, said, do you think that this, you'd want to see this turned into a book? And I said, no. I wouldn't want to see it turned into a book. And she said, well, do you mind if I show it to my food agent and maybe to some editors that might be interested? And so I knew she liked the essay. She talked about it a lot, but I didn't think that it would be much beyond that. And I really didn't think that I, as a fiction writer and a poet, I didn't think that I had a food book in me until I took on the task of writing an outline, of doing a synopsis for a potential book, which I kind of just took on as a writing exercise and wasn't really serious about it. And then suddenly, you know, not suddenly, after months of working on it, I thought, well, oh gosh, I really am interested in writing these stories and sort of paying homage to my ancestors and talking about their food ways, which is different, you know, and even have the race imposed. There's Appalachian food ways, and I think that, you know, the Black Appalachian food ways was a little bit different. And then that is certainly different from what goes on in the Deep South or what goes on in the North. And so I thought that one of the things I'm always interested in as a writer is finding something, a story that's different. So I did realize, you know, when you grow up in a particular way, you think, oh, well, this story is just our story, and you don't think of it as in contrast or in conversation with other lives. But I did see that there was a whole there that this book provides, that this book feels. And so I got really excited about it at that point.
Yeah, well, there's so much great material here, not just about food, but about the people's connections with each other through food. But from a publishing perspective, this is probably the biggest book you've ever done. It'll be distributed nationally by Clarkson Potter, a Penguin imprint. And it was edited by food writer Francis Lamb, the host of the nationally broadcast public radio show, The Splendid Table. How did all that come about?
Well, it actually is the book. My fiction and poetry is extremely jealous. Let me say that as a writer.
Yeah.
But I'm really excited. It came about in an auction, you know, during the pandemic. Again, I was sort of I worked really hard, so I wasn't like lackadaisical about this. But my agent said, okay, I think the synopsis looks good. I'm going to send it out. Are you okay with that? And I said, yeah. We'll see. Let it fly. We'll see what happens. And so immediately, all of the big houses were interested in it. And then the next week, she had asked me to cancel all my classes because we were doing Zoom at the time, to cancel all my classes because we were going to auction and I was going to have to talk to all of the big seven editors. And I thought, I can't cancel my classes, but oh my gosh. And so that's how we got to that point. And what I can say about Francis is that, you know, of course, money was involved, but even more than that to me was to tell this story in as rich a way as possible. So much love and tenderness was put in from the press. And you often don't think about that from a big press, but from the cover design to the font, to the end papers, to the editing, to the photography that's done and the careful placement and use of my archival photographs from my family. It's just really beautiful. It's going to be hard for me to go on tour because I cry at every end just looking at the book, and it's really beautiful, and I'm proud of the writing and the treatment of it.
It is a beautiful book. Well, what do you hope readers take away from this book?
One of the things that's happened, and this is my only hope, one of the things that's happened already is when I read from the book, inevitably, after I'm done, someone comes up, and it's people, you know, it's been Native, Indigenous people, it's been East Indian people, it's been white Appalachians, white Northerners, other Black people from various regions across the country, and they say, reading this particular part, and it's always something different, reminded me of my grandmother. Or when you wrote about this, I imagined what my great-grandmother would have went through, who I never got to meet. And I think that will be the biggest thing, that by reading about my kitchen ghosts, that other people can begin to explore their own kitchen ghosts and appreciate them.
Yeah, well, it's a really wonderful book. Once again, it's called Praise Song for the Kitchen Ghost, Stories and Recipes from Five Generations of Black Country Cooks by Crystal Wilkinson. Crystal, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
This is Tom Eblin for the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning, reporting for Eastern Standard.
Crystal Wilkinson's book will be published on January 23rd and can be pre-ordered wherever you purchase your books. Coming up after the break, is America sleepwalking through one of the most consequential years in recent memory?
I think several of us have used that very word, sleepwalking, in part because we're normal human beings. We can't think about this all day, every day.
Longtime Atlantic contributor Tom Nichols with us when we return in a moment. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Berea College. With a commitment to serving Appalachian students, Berea has not charged tuition since 1892. All students participate in a paid work program, providing professional experience as well as an inclusive, supportive education. Details at berea.edu.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events and artist opportunities provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. The Lost Art Club for Adult Learners at Lexington's Living Arts and Science Center will present a class on natural dyeing, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m., February 23rd. For more information, visit lasclex.org. Richmond Area Arts Council and the NAACP of Richmond-Madison County will present an evening of elegance honoring African-American musicians and music educators of Kentucky, January 26th at the EKU Center for the Arts in Richmond. For more information and to purchase tickets, visit ekucenter.com. And the Olive Hill Center for Arts and Heritage will hold the first of its Craft Saturday series, January 27th. It will feature three workshops, basket weaving, printmaking, and pottery. Cost is $10 per workshop. For more information and to register, visit ohcae.org. I'm Sherry Lawson, now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
In her book, Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present, Ruth Benyette advises that history shows that autocrats always tell you who they are and what they're going to do. We just don't listen until it's too late. Former President Trump and his allies are not doing much to reassure those of us who are worried about his autocratic instincts. If anything, they seem to be leaning into those predictions. The Atlantic has published a special issue with 24 contributors forecasting what a second Trump presidency would look like, many of them depicting an autocratic regime. They include commentary by longtime Atlantic contributor Tom Nichols concerning the possible nature of a military loyal to Trump. Tom's work deals with issues involving Russia, nuclear weapons, and national security affairs. His views are informed by a quarter century as a professor, first of strategy and then national security affairs, at the Naval War College. Nichols is often sought for comment by the networks. He's a five-time Jeopardy champion. Also, if you're a fan of Succession on HBO, That was him appearing as right-wing political commentator Ben Stove in the episode America Decides. Tom Nichols, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what sorts of signaling of authoritarian intentions of a second Trump administration have you observed, and to what degree should these indications be taken seriously?
You know, the interesting thing about Trump is that it's not even subtle signaling, because that's just not Trump's personality. His idea of signaling is to tell you point blank that, yes, he will be a dictator on day one, that he intends to use the government against his enemies, that he intends to round people up, that he intends to prosecute the free press if they criticize him, and on and on. You know, normally in other authoritarian systems, sometimes you get these threats, but sometimes you'll get a more subtle kind of populism where the candidate says things like, we're going to empower the poor, or we're going to, give the government back to the people. Trump doesn't even bother with any of that nuanced signaling or signposting. He just says point blank, yeah, I'm going to use the government to go after my enemies. And, I'm going to undermine free speech and free enterprise. And he does it unapologetically.
The Heritage Foundation has put out a paper titled Project 2025 that kind of lays out all of this. Tell us about that, if you could.
Yeah, Project 2025 is interesting, but some of it is just right-wing wonkery and policy dreaming. If we conservatives had control of the government, what would we do to tax rates and defense spending and things like that? But there's a really dark undertone to a lot of it, where there are also sections, for example, in the section on the military that I wrote about, where the chapter written by a former Trump Secretary of Defense, Acting Secretary Chris Miller, says things like, we're going to root out Marxist indoctrination in the military. Now, there's an example of signaling, because what they really mean to say is, we're going to purge officers that we think are insufficiently loyal to Donald Trump and to what we want. We're going to, kick all the trans people out of the military. We're going to bring people back into the military who refused orders to take COVID vaccines, and so on. So some of what Heritage is up to is just the usual kind of white paper, bureaucratic wish casting, but some of it's really quite dark.
What did Trump and his allies learn about military leadership during the first term?
Trump and his people learned about the military what they learned about everything else in the U.S. government in their first term, which is that if you're going to control these institutions, you have to act fast, you have to be ruthless, you have to put flunkies and cronies, as one of my Atlanta colleagues, David Frum, said, it's going to be an administration of freaks and weirdos. You have to get all of those people into those positions right on the first day. What really, I think, helped the country and hindered Trump's plans was that in the first Trump administration, he relented under a lot of pressure to bring in establishment Republican types, the grownups in the room. So his Secretary of Defense was James Mattis, and Rex Tillerson, a Secretary of State. Tillerson was not a great Secretary of State, but he wasn't beholden to Trump. And both of these guys, as well as Jeff Sessions at the Justice Department, these were all people who had agreed to serve in a Republican administration, but had limits. They were the people who would say, no, Mr. President, we're not doing that. This is a bad idea. This is unconstitutional. It's undemocratic. It's unethical. It's illegal, whatever. But these were the people who would say no. What Trump and his team have learned is, don't ever have people like that in your administration again. Make sure that the people you bring with you the next time are flunkies and toadies and yes men who are just going to do what they're told to do, whether it's legal or constitutional or ethical or moral.
And what was learned about how to skirt congressional approval of Defense Department nominees?
You know, it's interesting, because the first Trump term really showed us how much of the Constitution is not built on black letter law, but is built on norms, on handshakes, on an understanding that if the Senate rejects your nominee, then the Senate, in its Article I, power, and its constitutional authority, the president is Article II, the Congress is Article I, the judiciary is III, that in this system of divided powers, that if the Senate, in its advise and consent function, says no, the president says, okay, I'm going to try again.
You know, but the Senate operates on the presumption that the president should have his people as long as they are not completely unacceptable. What Trump and his people learned the first time around is to hell with all that, to hell with the Senate, to hell with the Constitution and its checks and balances. If you don't like the Senate's answer, and this actually happened in the first Trump term toward the end, if you don't like the Senate's answer, take the people they've rejected and send them over into those offices in an acting capacity anyway. Or just have them sit next to the guy who's already doing the job. This actually happened with the number three job in the Pentagon, where Trump wanted to nominate a guy named Anthony Tata, who's kind of a, you know, kook, believes in some pretty crazy conspiracy theories. And the Senate said no. And Trump sent him over to the Pentagon to sit in the same office as the guy who was already doing the job. That's what they learned. If the Senate says no, you say, well, you know, I don't happen to respect the Senate. And there's really no mechanism for dealing with that because the Constitution did not envision somebody as destructive as Donald Trump.
Well, I mentioned that you taught senior officers at the Naval War College. You retired after 25 years of doing that in 2022. And so I'd like to ask you, Tom, if you could, to recall what you heard among some of those senior officers that hinted at polarization or even maybe extremism among members of the military.
When I began my career at the Naval War College, I actually had officers in my seminars who had been prior enlisted in Vietnam, which shows you how old they were and how old I am now. But one of the things that I always took great comfort from about our officer corps is that they are resolutely non-political. Now, that doesn't mean they don't have political opinions. That doesn't mean that they don't have political leanings, but that by and large, they see themselves as a professional military. This is one of the things that's always been a great blessing in the American system, that they serve the Constitution, not any particular president. By the time I left, I was encountering more and more, and still, thankfully, a pretty small minority, but nonetheless, more than I was comfortable with, a cadre and a cohort of officers who, first of all, were hip deep in Fox News conspiracy theory stuff. This would come out in class. I'd get questions that were almost like directly from, you know, Fox News primetime the night before. I mean, really crazy stuff about George Soros and climate conspiracies and China, and, you know, really sort of out there. But also that I think there was, you know, a sense that some of that non-political or apolitical wall between elected politicians and the military was getting chipped away at by Donald Trump and his talk about, you know, my generals and my military and my army. And I want to reassure people, because I think 99.99% of the U.S. officer corps, they're intelligent, intensely loyal, and understand their constitutional duty. But as I say in the article in The Atlantic, all Trump needs is a very small handful of people at the top in the Pentagon or at the top of the Defense Department. And that's where things get dicey, because then everyone else in the military is looking for guidance from the chain of command. And that's actually a good thing. You don't want every officer in the military trying to decide what's constitutional and what's not. But that means that if Trump can seize a small number of posts, both uniformed and civilian, at the top of the chain, then we're set up for a conflict within the defense establishment. And that worries me a lot.
Well, as you note in the Atlantic piece, the military is trained and organized to obey, not resist, the orders of the civilian commander-in-chief. And you cite an unfortunate vulnerability in the modern American armed forces. What's the nature of that vulnerability or weakness?
I worry that the military is a lot like the rest of society, which is that we don't really teach civics. We don't really teach the Constitution. I know that I and some of my colleagues at other senior military institutions, we've tried over the years to get more direct study of the Constitution and of civil-military relations into the curriculum. And that's been hard to do because, you know, we have a lot of things that have to go into a curriculum. Senior war colleges, by the way, are only a one-year program. So it's not like we have them for, you know, a year, year and a half, 2 years where we can do a lot of this. And I worry that there is a kind of lack of political literacy, again, reflecting the same lack that's in the general public, to say the military would not obey a constitutional order. Well, what would constitute an unconstitutional order? We have rules of armed conflict. So there are some orders that are clearly illegal, kill POWs, for example, would be a classic example because we're signatories of the Geneva Conventions. But, you know, there's a lot of gray areas about what the president can order and what the military is required to do. And again, we've never drawn these out in black and white letter law because we've always counted on the fundamental decency and constitutional loyalty of the civilian command so that the military wouldn't be put in this position. But what do you do if the commander in chief is fundamentally indecent or, you know, in my view, an actual sociopath who's going to issue crazy orders? And I give examples, you know, in the piece about where Trump has said he admires people who have committed war crimes, people who he promised when he ran in 2016, if I tell my generals to engage in torture, they'll just do it. Well, I don't think that's true, but I think when you have this political vulnerability about the Constitution, about law, about the separation of powers that I think runs throughout American society and in the U.S. military, then I think you're getting into some dangerous territory.
There's a 143-year-old law out there. It's the Posse Comitatus Act. It's based on a conviction that military interference in civilian affairs, an army turned inward, is a threat to both democracy and personal liberty. But aides to the former president are said to be working on plans to invoke the Insurrection Act on the first day in office, we've heard that said, to allow him to deploy the military against civil demonstrations. Were that to happen, how do you think military leadership would react?
I don't know. Depends on who those leaders are. I'd be comfortable saying that 99 times out of 100, I think that the military would say, you know, that some military leaders would say, we're not giving that order, Mr. President. We're just not going to do that. On the other hand, what happens if, if you have a very small group at the top of flunkies and loyalists who say, no, good idea, the Insurrection Act is now in force, and we're going to issue orders to the military to go into the streets. The last time that happened was the LA riots. Presidents can, in fact, use the military within the country under very carefully circumscribed circumstances. But my hope, my faith is that this wouldn't happen. And it's also possible. I mean, you know, Trump and his people love to kind of provoke everyone else in the public space by saying things like we're going to, you know, use the Insurrection Act. The problem is that Trump, being so ignorant and so impulsive, you know, once you're the president, when you say something, it's not an opinion, it's an order. The last time he said during the BLM riots and during the disorder in Washington, when he said, I want to put the military out there, there were people around him and he wanted to do this. And his own Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, others around him said, that's a bad idea. Don't do that. Basically, you're asking me what happens if those people aren't in the room the next time? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Well, you write that the 2020 election is the source of Trump's chief grudge against senior military leaders. Refresh our memories about that.
Yeah, I mean, Trump carries a grudge against all of the institutions of American life about the 2020 election. He carries a particular grudge against the Defense Department and the Justice Department. He wanted to go to the riots. He wanted the military to protect his people. He wanted the military to either help him or get out of the way. And when the chairman, you know, called in other top commanders and said, now we all understand, you know, the chain of command, and we all understand our constitutional duties, he was enraged by that. And when General Milley, with the Secretary of Defense's permission, when he talked to our Chinese counterpart, his Chinese counterpart, about our political issues, and, you know, because there were some concerns, Trump later said he wants Milley executed. So again, you know, going back to your question about signaling, you know, to say, well, I would have strong disagreements with the chairman, you know, that's signaling. To say, I think the chairman should get the death penalty is just telling you straight up what he plans to do. And so right at the end of his term, he tried to purge the top positions in the Defense Department, including the Secretary of Defense. And that's why we ended up with an acting Secretary of Defense and all of these other kind of hangers-on and sycophants during the January 6th insurrection.
Well, remind us, if you would, of the joint statement that was put out in January of 2021 by all 10 living former secretaries of defense.
imagine that every living Secretary of Defense felt the need to sign on to a statement that told the current Secretary of Defense to remember his oath and to observe our great tradition of the peaceful transfer of power and basically stay out of politics. That wasn't a bunch of never Trumpers. That wasn't a bunch of, you know, left wingers or right wingers. That was every living former Secretary of Defense going public to tell the top leaders of the Pentagon, remember your duty and your oath. That should have been a terrifying red flag to everyone in the United States. And I think it probably did some good, but I also think that most people simply didn't grasp what a remarkable moment that was, and what a real step away from, I don't want to say protocol, but from tradition, to have former secretaries of defense telling this, you know, this acting, so this nobody who had been thrust into the job as a Trump loyalist, remember your duty, remember your oath. And that was really quite a moment.
Well, you, in your article, you lay out your most serious concerns, even if only some of the actions that you described end up succeeding. What should we be thinking about? What should we consider here?
Well, there are multiple nightmares that could occur if Trump is returned to office. And of course, as you point out, 24 Atlantic authors point out how that could work across the board. Where the military is concerned, Trump could issue orders well within his power to simply cease cooperating with our allies, to bring troops back from allied installations, to send clear messages to Russia and China that we have no interest in defending our allies. At home, he could do all kinds of things. For example, remember that during his first term, he got very infatuated with, I think it was Bastille Day parades in France. He could use the military to try to put on shows of political loyalty. You know, I'm going to campaign in Kentucky. Throw me a parade. Make sure everybody knows that the army is on my side. Because he's tried to do that over in his first term. He kept trying to make the point that the people with guns, the army, law enforcement, the FBI, these guys, you know, except for the traitors and the haters, right, that he always identifies within these organizations, that the rest of them are secretly all on his side. He could do fairly relatively benign things like ordering shows of loyalty, ordering the military into the streets for ceremonial reasons. And then there are the things that he could do that are a lot more terrifying. He could try to order the military to commit war crimes. He called the Pentagon in his first term and said, kill Bashar Assad. Jim Mattis picked up the phone, said, okay, Mr. President, we'll get right on that. And then the Secretary of Defense hung up the phone and turned to an aide and said, we're not going to do that. Now, that's a problem in itself. I think people should think about that. You don't want to have a situation where the Secretary of Defense feels the need to hang up the phone and say, I was just told by the president to do this, but I'm not going to do this. And I worry that Trump, in the end, is less dangerous in terms of actually unleashing the military throughout America, because I think most military commands just reject that. But I'm worried about him provoking a confrontation between his loyalists and constitutionally loyal forces in the Pentagon or in the other places in the Defense Department, with all these kind of, you know, crackpot orders and half-baked ideas that he could start issuing simply because once he's back in the Oval, he could do it.
Well, I think it's fair to say that as a society, we're just inundated with information, and maybe as a result of that, a little dazed and confused on a daily basis about what's going on. But do you ever get the sense, Tom, that as a society, we're kind of sleepwalking through all of this and not paying close enough attention?
I think several of us have used that very word, sleepwalking, in part because we're normal human beings. We can't think about this all day, every day. I mean, I'm paid to think about it all day and write about it. And even I, you know, have to just kind of unplug and turn the TV off and step away. But I think sleepwalking is the right word, because we're all ruled by something called a normalcy bias. We all believe in normalcy, that tomorrow really can't be that different from today. This is part of why we're so shocked when someone we know dies, or when there's a disaster, or when our lives are turned upside down, if we're fired from a job, whatever it is. Suddenly, the new day is not like the day you expected. And so I think people keep telling themselves it's going to be normal. It'll be the same, maybe a little different, but not a big problem, because I can't get my head around the idea, people would say, that this guy really follows through and starts, you know, arresting his opponents and shutting down TV stations and putting the army in the streets and doing all this other stuff. And I think that's really, really hard for people to get around. I had lunch earlier today with a friend who asked me about this, and he said, you could hear it in his voice. He said, you know, I mean, he's just one guy. He can't do all this. He can't pull this off. And I said, you know, every authoritarian regime begins with somebody saying, how much damage can one guy do? And then they find out. So I think that's a normal human instinct, but I think we have to overcome it, and we have to stop having failure of imagination about how bad this could be, because I think it could be very bad.
Atlantic contributor, Naval War College Professor Emeritus Tom Nichols, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you again for having me.
Coming in February, the first episode of an Eastern Standard Election Year special series hosted by Josh Douglas, a professor of election law and voting at the University of Kentucky.
Have you ever wondered how our elections actually work? Is our democracy really in a lot of trouble? Are we going to have a free and fair election in 2024? Those are the kinds of questions that keep me up at night and make me want to explain these vital issues to voters. When I first became a professor of election law, my dad asked me why I wanted to enter a field in which my expertise was relevant only once every 4 years. Little did he, or I, know that voting rights issues would be at the forefront every year. 2024, of course, is an election year, and everyone is talking about how this year's election will play out. We thought we witnessed an unprecedented election in 2020, what with a pandemic and a president running for re-election who refused to accept the results even before any votes were cast. 2024 could be even more dramatic. Democracy itself may be at stake. That statement might seem over the top, but our system will be tested like never before.
Go to the polls fully informed. Our series Democracy Optimist with Josh Douglas begins February 1st. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more, and you can sign up there for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and anywhere you get your podcasts. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.